Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets. My not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Hope you all had a wonderful Easter holiday. Here in the coast-to-coast command bunker, we've taken off our spurs, pulled off the boots. They're standing over there in the corner. The gun belt is unbuckled, but the Colt's within grabbing distance, just in case. You never know what goes on during a coast-to-coast broadcast. Tonight, we return to the Old West, to the time of gunslingers, outlaws, desperados, cagey characters on horseback who robbed trains and banks, rustled cattle and horses, thumbed their noses at the law for as long as they could. Many of them met bloody, violent ends. Many more still live on in our imaginations. You know, back when I was a kid, Westerns were the rage on television. Every network had its own lineup of Western programs, not just Gunsmoke. I mean, all kinds of shows, every one of them. Movie studios cranked out Western tales on a regular basis, white hats versus black hats. You know, times change, public tastes change, but those stories still rattle around in my brain and maybe yours as well. A couple of weeks ago, I was invited to a pretty amazing family reunion in Arizona. Not my family, somebody else's family. And in a sense, it was more than a family reunion. It was like a gathering of the outlaw clans. At this gathering, there were some in the family who could trace their roots to Jesse James. Some in the family could trace themselves to a guy named Black Jack Ketchum. Many of these family members didn't realize that they were related to folks who ran with the Wild Bunch, that loose confederation of outlaws that's been chronicled in so many books and so many movies. And the most famous of all, the Wild Bunch Outlaws, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. You know, the movie we all know, the one with Paul Newman and Robert Redford, a marvelous piece of filmmaking. I don't know about you, but I didn't like the ending. I wanted Butch and Sundance to escape. I didn't want them to die in some podunk town in Bolivia. Over the years, I've read just about anything and everything that's been written about Butch and Sundance, or anything I could get my hands on anyway, especially the stories about how maybe they didn't die in Bolivia after all. Maybe they returned to the States and lived out until they were old men. Now, maybe that's wishful thinking. Maybe it's Western fantasy, and maybe not. During that gathering in Arizona, a famous Western writer and publisher named Bob Bose Bell spoke, and he told the crowd, and I remember this phrase, he says, "Nothing changes as much as the past." And isn't that true? I mean, we learn that on this program all the time. The more we learn about the past, the more we learn about how wrong we've been about it. I thought it might be fun for one of our programs to explore the alternative history of the Old West. We do those kinds of alternative history programs on Coast now and then, but as far as I know, we haven't done one that focused on Old West tales. Well, tonight, that changes. We start with Butch and Sundance. And I don't think anyone in the world has done more work on tracking down the real story on those two than Kerry Ross Boren. He and his wife, Lisa Lee Boren, have co-authored a massive and impressive new history called Butch Cassidy, The Untold Story. It's a very impressive piece of work, amazing details and photos, and they make a persuasive case that Butch Cassidy did not die in South America, in part because a heck of a lot of people saw him years later here. Instead, they think Cassidy had a long, colorful life and ended his days right here in my neck of the woods, Nevada. The Borens will join me momentarily, and we will jump right into it. In Hour 3 tonight, Jerry Nickel is not only a writer and storyteller, he says he is the great-grandson of the Sundance Kid. He makes the case in his book that there was a lot of confusion about the true identity of Sundance, and that was on purpose. And he says he has DNA evidence that proves Sundance also survived South America, died many years later in Utah. Then in hour four, we're going to explore one of the most infamous bank robberies of all time, at least in Western history. You know, historians for a long time believed that the robbery of the First National Bank in Winnemucca, here in Nevada, was the work of the Wild Bunch. Maybe that's Butch Cassidy's gang. Maybe old Butch himself was involved, they figured. The town of Winnemucca even held a festival, Butch Cassidy Days, and sort of cashed in on that story. I think most historians have since concluded Butch was not there himself. He wasn't involved in that robbery. Now comes an explosive new tale. You know, even though Butch wasn't there, nobody's really explained, well, if he didn't do it, who did? Well, the story that we're going to hear now is about who really staged that robbery. Chet and Kim Brackett are not writers by trade. They're ranchers. But they wanted to tell a story after they found a stash of old handwritten notes written by their late relative, a man who knew the truth about the Wild Bunch and about that bank job. And this truth leads to a name that is well known in the West, but not as an outlaw. He's known as a pillar of his community, owner of one of the largest ranches in America, a solid citizen whose colorful past is about to catch up with him. Chet and Kim will be here later in the program, and they have quite a story to tell. So as you can hear, it's a full slate tonight, and I want to get right to it. Our webmaster, Greg Bishop, and I put together our usual assortment of oddities and items culled from the world's news media. We call it Naps News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast website. Can't miss it, really, if you tune in there. Among the stories featured tonight, a really excellent feature from True West Magazine, which is a pretty good magazine if you follow this kind of history. We picked this one to get us all in the proper mindset. It's a story about the friendship between Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday. These are real men, not TV characters. They had a real interesting relationship, friendship, to a lot of people that didn't make sense. And Wyatt Earp, by the way, has links to some of the folks we're going to talk about later tonight. Also, a modern tale of terror, in a sense. It's about what Big Pharma is pulling now, the latest trick. Also, are scientists getting to the point where they could clone Jesus? If they could find the DNA, could they make a Jesus? Figure that story might work for Easter. And a dazzling light show was detected on a moon in our solar system. It has scientists thinking there is a likelihood of life in our galactic neighborhood. That and more in tonight's Naps News. While you're there on the Coast website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. It's a great bargain, a good deal. 15 cents a day if you've subscribed for a year gives you access to a vast archive of previous programs, including classics. You can listen as often as you want on just about any device. You can also find out while you're there how to subscribe to George Norrie's TV show, which covers many of the topics we discuss here. And George, as I recall, is appearing on stage in L.A. coming up in early May. There's information on how you can attend and hear what he has to say. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog. Bring in the cat. Maybe toss some extra hay out there for your horse. Put on a big pot of Joe. Perhaps add a shot of rot gut to that coffee. Slip into those jammies, the ones with the rawhide tassels. You know the ones I mean. Plop yourself down in a comfy spot. Turn down the lights and turn up the radio, because we're ready to rumble in a moment. Butch Cassidy, The Untold Story, with Carrie and Lisa Borin. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. There's a scene in the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid where the two outlaws are scared. They're being pursued by this super posse. They're in trouble. They go to town. They reach out to this grumpy old lawman who's a friend of theirs, and they try to make a deal. And he tells them, look, you know, you guys might be big time here in this area, but you're still just two-bit outlaws, and you're going to die bloody, and it's only a matter of where and when. So were Butch and Sundance just two-bit outlaws made famous by a big Hollywood movie, or were they more than that? And did they die in a Bolivian shootout as portrayed in that film? Kerry Ross Boren is an historical writer who's pursued this story for decades, and he's put together a staggering amount of information. And together with Lisa Lee Boren, they make their case in this gargantuan new book, Butch Cassidy, The Untold Story. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here for the first time.
Thank you.
Carrie, I learned in reading this book and others, articles, about how cutthroat the Western history arena can be. You know, I don't think there are any of you writers get out and duel at dawn on Main Street kind of thing, but almost. It's kind of like the UFO field. There are turf wars, and and you're carving out your own territory, it makes you a target, right? Am I wrong?
No, you're correct. There seems to be a new breed of neo-historians out there who go into the act of character assassination if you don't agree with their theories. And for that reason, I kind of backtracked and stay out of the mainstream and just work on my work by myself.
You know, in looking at your book, it's clear in the acknowledgments just how close to this story you are personally. I mean, you're not interviewing just people whose grandparents may have heard a story about Butch and Sundance and their family. You spoke to people who knew them directly and told you what you're about to tell us. That's right?
That's true. I grew up in northeastern Utah in a place where an old friend of mine, John Ralph Burroughs, in his book called Where the Old West Stayed Young, there were a myriad of old-timers from that era who were throwbacks to the Old West scene, and most of them knew Butch, and many of them were related to his family. So most of the information was first and sometimes secondhand.
And I notice in reading the book that your family's various figures in your family pop up. I mean, you've got some outlaw blood there as well.
Yes, both of my grandfathers, my paternal and maternal grandfather, knew Butch very well, and my paternal grandfather helped him rob a train, and so that is very close. My grandmother was raised in Butch's family as a foster child, so she was literally a foster sister to Butch.
And did you hear these stories?
One of my uncles was named for Butch.
Did you hear these stories growing up? Yeah, don't tell anybody, but Butch didn't die in South America. Is that how you got hooked?
I think that's what got me started very early in life. I'd heard these stories around the campfires, and all of these old-timers who knew them firsthand just laughed at the stories that they had died in South America. One old-timer, Tommy Welch, who had ridden with Butch, used to laugh and say, well, if Butch is dead, I had a drink with a very lively ghost in a bar in Rock Springs not many years ago.
Lisa, how did you get hooked on it? And did you believe it the first time you heard it?
Actually, I did. I think with me, when I started researching everything that Carrie did, every time that I would look at what he did and then what people were saying, they always went back to his research as being the most valid, the most accurate. And this was from the time that he was a young man and up until now. And what confirms it for me is that since we've published Butch, many of the descendants of these old-timers or old outlaw families, or even just those people on the fringes who had known Butch, they're relating that either their grandfather, grandmother, or people in their family had told these very same stories and had passed them down to their families. Well, Carrie couldn't have gone and just told them to say to the world, you know, tell them this story because it comes from me and it's true. They're actually telling these stories to their family members and they're passing them down. And so we've received confirmation after confirmation, people saying, it's so refreshing to find out what my granddad said or my great-granddad said is true. In fact, when we published the book and we went down to Moab, I was doing a radio interview and Carrie was back doing some book signings, and a young man came up and asked him where Butch died, and Carrie told him and related the story, and he said, you know, I want you to know I'm a member of the Parker family, and nobody knows that but us. And he says, you are absolutely correct. He died in Leeds, Utah. And so that was a confirmation again from a family member.
And were you amazed at the turf wars that come with this territory? I mean, Carrie's been at it a long time, but you've been at it for a while now, but I imagine that was painful when you first were exposed to it, about how hostile people can get to a story that changes a version of history that they're invested in.
I really was amazed and saddened by it, because unfortunately people don't keep an open mind to say, this could possibly be true. Whereas for us, it is the truth, because there's just so much evidence to from people who knew him to Carrie's own grandfather going to see Butch just before he died. And I think what was really sad for me is when I first married him, how many times Carrie had willingly shared information, such as who Sundance, Harry Longabaugh, truly was. He shared it with family members. He shared what Sundance, alias Sundance, died under. And other people have taken credit for his work over and over and over. And that really was hard for me because for him, he said, I don't care. But to me, I cared. I'm like, you should get credit for what you do. But he says, it's hard to convince people if they're so set on their ways and their belief system to tell them otherwise. He says, I know the truth, and that's important to him. And he had set out in his life to stand at the foot of Butch Cassidy's grave, the Sundance Kid's grave, and Etta Place. And he's done two of those three, and we just have yet to do Etta Place's grave.
Well, we'll come back and talk about Etta and what might have become of her. Let's talk about Butch and Sundance first. Carrie, I remember seeing you, I think, on a television program. It was like 1979 or 80, and what caught my attention was the idea that there was a Nevada angle to it. I figured as a reporter here, I'm going to look into this stuff, and have chased it off and on ever since. But this book now has renewed my interest in it. Let's start with the broad strokes story of Butch and Sundance, who they were. I mentioned that quote from the movie about how they were two-bit outlaws. And there are writers who try to downgrade how important they were or where they stand in the pantheon of Old West outlaws. Some people exaggerate what they did. Some people downplay it. Where are you? Tell me who these guys were and why we should still care about them.
Well, I think that they're very unique characters in Western history. And I don't think they can be overlooked for the contributions they made. Certainly we can't applaud their endeavors, but I think we have to admit that they were very unique in their trade.
Well, how? I mean, you know, sometimes in some versions of the story, they're almost portrayed as Robin Hood. But they, I mean, while they weren't bloodthirsty killers, they were outlaws, robbers, right?
Oh, they definitely were that. I think probably the Robin Hood angle comes mostly from Butch, who was known to be very generous and who often helped widows save their farms and many of the things that Jesse James was attributed to. And so I think most of that comes from him.
But Sundance, on the other hand, he was a deadly killer. And so he wasn't adverse to killing somebody, whereas Butch never killed a man. And he was quite proud of himself for that. He was known for his benevolence to many people. And if you read the book, that's shown quite adequately in the book, where he's helped many of the Mormons escape and get down to Juarez, Mexico. And he helped with a population of Native Americans in Alaska taking medicine over a mountain in a mountain storm to them. Sundance wasn't quite that way.
So, Carrie, why don't you tell us how Butch got on the outlaw trail? Because, I mean, he comes from a good family, the Parker family. Robert Leroy Parker's his birth name. How does he become Butch Cassidy? Why did that happen?
Well, I think he was a product of his time. Excuse me, I have a bit of a cold tonight. I apologize. He was a product of his time. His father had lost his ranch in a dispute. And it sort of made him a little leery of authority. And in order to recoup some of those losses, he set out on the rustling trail, as many of the young men of that community did at that time. And it escalated from there. Once he was on the run, it was very hard to return.
And the Cassidy name comes from a guy, Mike Cassidy, whom he admired?
Yes, exactly. Mike Cassidy's real name was Todd McClammy. He was a Montana cowboy who drifted out into Utah and entered into the rustling trade.
right, we're about to go to a break here. When we come back, I'll ask Lisa to tell us about the Sundance Kid's real name, and then we'll get into the circumstances that led them to South America and whether or not they died down there, what the evidence is for whether they came back. A Bobby Fuller from 1964, I Fought the Law, is the song taking us into the break. Coast to Coast resumes in a moment. The song, the album, and the artist all have the same name. It's called Bad Company, of course. It's from 1973, kind of a Western-themed sound to it, but it's actually written about Victorian morals. At least that's what I read. We're talking with Kerry Ross Boren, the Lisa Lee Boren, about their new book, a massive work called Butch Cassidy, The Untold Story. Robert Leroy Parker is Butch Cassidy's real name. And when we come back, we're going to get into who Sundance really was and then how they became members of the Wild Bunch and how they ended up in South America. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Lisa Lee Boren, we heard just a couple of moments ago about Butch Cassidy's real name. Tell me a little bit about Sundance. Your book is about Butch, but I mean, Butch and Sundance are kind of like peanut butter and jelly in a sense that they're always going to be linked together. So give us a little bit about the real Sundance.
Well, yeah. First of all, you should know that Kerry was the one, being a genealogist, he was the one who broke the line of the Linebaugh or the Longabaugh line, and nobody really knew who the Sundance Kid was, his real name. He was born in Pennsylvania into an ironworks family, and he grew up doing ironworks. His uncle did cannons, made cannons for the war effort. And he did that until about the age of 15 when he joined up or went west to join up with his cousin in Colorado where he met his, where he met Butch Cassidy actually. So that's kind of a synopsis on the Sundance Kid.
And would you, how would you describe their friendship, the nature of the friendship, what you can discern from people who knew him, knew them?
I would say that they were close, but at the same time, they did have some professional differences, which, as I said before, he was more benevolent, and Sundance could have a mean streak in him. And so I think they got along, but I think at the same time, they did have some differences now and then.
And Kerry, they're described in, you know, in the movie, it's Hollywood stuff. So Sundance is this great shot and Butch is so good with horses and they're both pretty smart and cagey outlaws. I mean, is that pretty close to the story? I mean, they were master horsemen, which had a lot to do with how they succeeded in their life of crime, right?
Oh, yes, they certainly were that. My grandfather told the story of Butch Cassidy riding around a tree with just knee pressure on his horse and placing bullet holes an inch apart around the tree. He's very proficient with the gun. Harry Longabaugh, even more so. And in fact, my grandfather said that Butch was a better shot with a rifle than he was a pistol. And so, you know, they were men of their era and probably the most proficient member of the Wild Bunch gun-wise was Harvey Logan, Kid Curry.
We'll talk about the Wild Bunch a little bit. You know, of course, the flavor of the time, newspaper writers back east would inflate these tales and create myths, and separating fact from fiction is hard even for somebody like you. But, you know, I've seen stories that Butch Cassidy was the leader of a gang of cutthroats and killers of 500 outlaws. Give me a sense of this loose confederation of outlaws and how it operated and what Butch and Sundance's position in that group was.
Well, I don't think the gang ever achieved that great a number. Most of that derives from when the gang was organized in Browns Park in about 1896. Over 300 outlaws from the surrounding states met there. And they all determined to elect a leader, and they called themselves the Train Robber Syndicate. They weren't known as the Wild Bunch until somewhat later. And so there were a number of them gathered, but the nucleus of the gang, I don't think ever amounted to more than maybe 10 or 15 top members.
And is it, can you call it Butch Cassidy's gang? I mean, I guess he would be a leader in some of the jobs, but it, I don't know that anybody was really the leader, was it?
I think in the beginning, there were two or three gangs. Harvey Logan, Kid Curry operated one out of Wyoming. There was the Robber's Roost gang. And a number of them, they all congregated together. I don't think they had really a leader. I think the leadership sort of developed over a period of time.
And Robber's Roost, Hole in the Wall, those are real places. They really were hideouts for these gangs at different times?
Yes, they were. They were locations along the Outlaw Trail, which ran from Canada to Mexico. And these stations were interspersed about a third of the distance each way. And they were places where the law very seldom visited. So it was very easy for them to hide out there with the assistance of the ranchers and things who lived there. And they often paid these ranchers handsomely for the use of their ranches, their livestock, and so forth. And so they made themselves very welcome in those places, whereas the law was not.
You know, I read about some of these bank holdups, and I guess by today's standards, it might not seem like a lot. They got 20,000 here. They got 30,000 from a train or a bank, 50,000, I think, at one point. But, I mean, that's an incredible amount of money for cowboys out there on the range.
It certainly was, especially since money was worth so much more in those days. Maybe $50,000 would amount to between $300,000 or $500,000 in today's money. But they often spend it about as fast as they got it. Matt Warner, a member of the gang, used to say that after a robbery, they would all say, well, the next one's going to be the big one, and we'll all retire. And then they would rob the bank or the train, and they would spend the money, they would gamble it away or give it away within weeks. And then it was, well, the next one's going to be the big one.
Lisa, can you describe sort of how the decision was made to head to South America? I mean, those who have seen the movie, you got a general idea that the pressure was on, that their days were numbered, and they realized it, so they decided to get out of town, in essence. But fill in some of the blanks in that part of the story, what you know from working on this book.
I think they really wanted to ranch down there and to stay a little bit of incognito, to stay out of the limelight of the Pinkerton detectives here in the United States. And so that was what led them. And if you go to that region, that region in South America is a lot like the West here, so they were very familiar with it. By no means did they just live the ideal ranch life down there. They were involved in all sorts of activities, including Etta Place when she was with them. So she sort of became known as a lady bandito down there. And yet at the same time, these were not backward cowboys. We have shown in our book that along with the enormous amount of money that they gained, they were world travelers. And they kind of ran in high societies, and they were all over the map, really. And so that's what's fascinating about them. They weren't just old country bumpkins who didn't know the world or uneducated. They were quite well-rounded. And South America, they would attend different parties and balls, and they were involved in a lot of things down there. So that was part of the reason for going, is just kind of lay a little bit low and to do some ranching. But at the same time, they had their eye on different things that they could rob as well.
I guess it's hard to change your stripes at that age, you know, in their late 30s, early 40s. The Pinkertons, Carrie, describe the Pinkertons. You know, they're the ace detective agency of the time. I have read, I don't know if it's for sure, that it sort of became a model for what became the Secret Service. The Pinkertons were hot on their trail and even were pursuing them after they left the country. Is that correct?
That is correct. Alan Pinkerton, who founded the agency, was sort of the Secret Service for the Abraham Lincoln administration. It was their job to protect the president, and they earned their reputation from that. And they branched out into different areas later and became quite famous for pursuing outlaws and getting their man.
But you have to understand, at the same time, the Pinkertons were not always accurate. They listed Sundance as being way too tall for what he was, different eye color. So they weren't always completely accurate in their descriptions of the outlaws.
That famous photo that everyone has seen, anyone who reads about Western history, that was taken in San Antonio of all these guys all duded up. I mean, they thought they were having a grand old time at the moment, but it really backfired on them, right, Kerry?
Well, it did. The photo was taken in Fort Worth.
Fort Worth.
And they all dressed up in nice suits. And then they wrote a letter to the bank president in Nevada stating that, as you can see, we're living high off the money we took from your bank. But it wasn't really so much of a surprise, since Nixon, who was the bank president, was a longtime friend of Butch's, and it's long been believed that it was an inside job with his help.
Well, amazingly enough, we're going to hear that from in the fourth hour of our program tonight with the Brackets, who are going to give us some insight on that as well. So you guys are on the same page there. I'll tell you what was a big surprise. One of the many big surprises in your book, Kerry, was in talking about the Pinkertons, who I guess were hot on the trail of Butch and Sundance, putting a lot of pressure on them. They assigned, among others, Charlie Siringo to go after them. You say that, you write in this, that Charlie Siringo actually, even though he was assigned the job of going after these guys, that he became friends with them.
He did. In fact, he at one time had a crush on Butch's younger sister, and he felt very remiss in trying to bring them to justice. In many cases, he falsified reports and changed information to keep from bringing them to bay.
And that sort of, it becomes part of the larger picture as well, is that people lied about what happened in South America, that they were, that other people who liked these guys were willing to sort of bend the truth a little bit to get the Pinkertons off their trail. Lisa, can you comment on that?
Well, they did. Many of the people who knew Butch Cassidy not only loved Butch Cassidy, but they defended him, and they often would do their best to protect him and lie for him and cover for him. And one of the things that Kerry did in his research is he even got to know the president of Bolivia many years ago, and they did an investigation on the bodies of the so-called bandidos down there who had purportedly died and was Butch and Sundance. And Rene Barrientos, the then president, they did their own investigative discovery, and they couldn't find anything to say that they were Butch and Sundance. And so I think that it bodes well in terms of how well-loved Butch was and how well-remembered he is.
Kerry, I've always thought it would be cool to have the follow-up movie. Is a scientific team is climbing up in the Andes, slowly climbing up some mountainside, maybe have burros carrying their gear, and they get to the town of San Vicente where the climactic shootout supposedly happened, where Butch and Sundance are buried, where all the historians, the traditional historians, say, oh yeah, the proof is there. I remember reading the news stories, the front page story around the country. Finally, they're digging up the graves that everyone has said, this is where Butch and Sundance are. The bandidos Yankees are there. We're going to prove it with DNA. And then the DNA evidence comes back. It's not them. It's not them, right?
Exactly. Rene Barrientos had the bodies exhumed in 1965, and it was proven at that time that it wasn't them. But those who exhumed the bodies, they did it, of course, for Nova Television, and they had already done the exhumation of the bodies. I spoke with Dr. Clyde Snow, who is the forensic pathologist who did the work, the investigative work on them. And they had already determined that they were going to do this story about their death there, and they were not about to listen to any other opinion because, of course, it would have destroyed the premise of their film.
At the same time, Dr. Clyde Snow kept agreeing with Carrie when they were interviewing Carrie that Carrie was on the right path. And, in fact, the Nova documentary pretty much proved that that wasn't Butch and Sundance. And the DNA testing for Sundance, what they did, they dug up one of Sundance's relatives, and it did not match the DNA testing with one of the bodies remains that they were able to recover. It did not match.
And yet you have writers in this field that still stick to that story. Well, they must be buried somewhere in that graveyard, right?
Well, yeah, it's very hard to change people's opinions once they make them. And there seems to be a new breed of researchers out there who, as I say, they resort more to character assassination than they do intelligent discussions about the possibilities. And so if you disagree with their premise, you are pretty much set up as a target.
You know, we're not out to disprove or prove anything. We write what we write, and then we let people determine for their own what they want to believe. We presented the evidence and the many stories told, as Carrie had stated in earlier, firsthand that he was able to gather from people, from these people who had known Butch, from his own family members and other members of the Old Wild Bunch, people who rode with Butch. And, you know, a lot of the historians now, they can't make that claim. They can't make that claim that they knew any of these people. Carrie is 75 years old. He can make that claim because he interviewed them. He knew them before they passed away. And so that's a lot different from what the many historians are out there now. He was very close, and he had a very unique upbringing, a part of Western Americana that most people never have an opportunity to ever experience.
Carrie, we're going to go to a break in about a minute. On the other side, we'll talk about the witnesses who came forward and talked to you and said that Butch and Sundance returned, that they lived on for many years. At the end of your book, though, you've got a page. I had to chuckle at it. Here's the list of people who saw Butch and Sundance die in South America. Pick up the story from there.
Well, that page is blank. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever to support that they died in South America, whereas the evidence is overwhelming that they returned. They were seen by multiple witnesses of people that knew them well, including members of their own family. And it can't be intelligently argued any longer that they died in Bolivia.
You know, for people like me, it's just kind of wishful thinking. You don't want to see them die in that situation. You'd think they're too smart to get caught like that. But you're convinced this goes way beyond wishful thinking, and we'll get into that in details in the next hour, right?
You bet. We will. We'll get into the details of it.
Okay. Lula Parker Bettinson's Butch's sister came here to Nevada, and Carrie, I think you came here with her, and
yes, I did.
Went to a place called Johnny, Nevada. I was there about 2 days ago, poking around, following some of the clues that are in your book. And we'll talk about why Johnny, Nevada became part of this story, and some of the witnesses who say that Butch and Sundance returned, that they saw them firsthand, in our next segment. We're talking with Carrie Ross Boren and Lisa Lee Boren about their book, Butch Cassidy, The Untold Story. Bon Jovi's 1990 song. This was written for a movie, Young Guns 2, Blaze of Glory. We'll be right back.